All right. The court calls United States v. Davenport. Counsel for the appellant, please.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court, my name is Captain Brian Andes, and I, along with Major Vincent Schuler, represent Sergeant First Class Calvin J. Davenport, the appellant in this matter. The transcript in this case remains non-verbatim and therefore subject to the remedy in Rule for Courts Martial 1103F1. Because of the adjudged sentence and the sentence that the convening authority approved, the government had the responsibility to create a verbatim record of trial. Verbatim, as defined, verbatim means...
Hang on for 1 second. Is this a verbatim transcript case or verbatim record or trial case?
This is a verbatim transcript.
Okay, so forget complete or incomplete record?
Well, it's possible that it may be incomplete. You can't know beyond a reasonable doubt based on what took place at the Dubé hearing. But at the very least, we know that it was a non-verbatim transcript.
Okay. In terms of the facts, if parties don't entirely agree on just exactly what was missing, could you please characterize for us what you believe was missing, and then the government will have its chance. And by this, I mean how long. There's different ways of calculating, and you've got that 30-minute recess issue. So how long are we talking about from X to Y?
From the time the court was called to order to the time they came back from a recess is 103 minutes. During that time, seven witnesses testified. Six of those witnesses, there is recorded testimony for. Sergeant Smith is the seventh witness. And then there's a recess. We don't know how long the recess is. Based on the trial judge's notes, it's unclear. He doesn't write down how long the recess lasted.
Now, the government came up with the figure of 10 minutes. Why is that accurate? Why is that not accurate? Why is it gross speculation? Why is it thoughtful speculation?
3.5 years later, there's no way to know without anyone writing it down. It's based solely on the memories of the trial of witnesses of how long that recess lasted. And therefore, there's just no way to know how long the recess lasted for. They don't know what the purpose of the recess was for. There may or may not have been an 802 session, a 39A session. Nobody knows what all took place during the recess before the judge called court back to order and after Sergeant Smith was called to testify. It's noteworthy that the notes that the trial judge had regarding Sergeant Smith's testimony are about the same length as the notes that the judge had regarding the most prior witness, Mimi. And Mimi's testimony is about 10 pages long, so it's unclear exactly how many pages are missing from the record of trial because the page number stays the same on the bottom. It's missing just Sergeant Smith's testimony.
Is it your position? We know he's gone, Smith.
Yes.
Is it your position that something else is gone?
It's our position there's no way to know what else took place 3.5 years later. And there's differences in testimony at the Dubé of what all took place. One of the trial counsel states that he may or may not have questioned a witness after Sergeant Smith. Sergeant Smith says when he left, someone else came in and testified after him. The trial court reporter remembers there being some objections, but doesn't remember what the objections were. The judge says, whatever they were, they were probably insignificant because I didn't write them down. But the judge only took about 5 or 6 lines of what appears to be notes. They look like they would only be decipherable by the judge. And slight omissions, they are permissible where appellate courts can determine with a reasonable certainty the substance and sense of the question, answer, and argument. However, where the debate judge found, quote, the full substance and extent of Sergeant Smith's testimony is not altogether clear at Joint Appendix 166, and the Army court then found, quote, the government was unable to obtain or adequately reconstruct the exact testimony of Sergeant Smith at Joint Appendix page 7.
Okay, Dan. The interesting thing about this post-mortem is that, at the time, everybody had a chance to look at this transcript. trial counsel, defense counsel, and, of course, the judge who has to authenticate it.
Yes, sir.
And nobody noticed this.
No one noticed it until it came up to the Army Court for Appeals. This is the only case that I could find where it wasn't caught prior to the convening authority taking action. And that's why the rule for courts martial 1103 subparagraph F1 says what the convening authority may do, and that is limit the maximum sentence to that less than 6 months and no discharge, or send the case back for a rehearing. Let's say
there was a rehearing in this case. What would you do the rehearing on? Is the theory you could do a rehearing on the charge for which he was acquitted?
It would have to be a rehearing on the entire case, Your Honor.
How could you do a rehearing on the charge that he was acquitted on?
Doesn't 1103 say the hearing for the offenses if he was found guilty of, right?
Sorry, Your Honor.
I said 1103F says what the rehearing can be on, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
The charges that he was found guilty of?
Yes, Your Honor. And then...
Do you contest the various arguments, statements, conclusions, depending on how you characterize them, that the testimony from Sergeant Smith went entirely to the charge for which he was acquitted?
Yes, was there's acquitted. No way to know specifically. Although the government says that's why they called him, there's no way to know.
Can we infer that from how his testimony was or was not used in reference in closing arguments?
The only time Sergeant Smith's testimony is referenced specifically is by the defense in closing. The government references the defense references at Joint Appendix 118 and 119. The government references the money laundering charges, but doesn't specifically mention the name Sergeant Smith. Sergeant Smith's testimony clearly went to the strength and the merits of the government's case, and Rule 4, Courts Martial 1103 doesn't require verbatim transcription of only the offenses to which someone is found guilty. They require a verbatim transcription of the entire record of proceeding in order for those punishments to be given out, a verbatim record punishment.
How would you define substantial, or is it possible?
It is possible, yes. You know, a clear definition isn't, I guess a clear definition is impossible, but looking at the case law, and specifically Nelson, Lashley, and Eichenlaub, where this court found that insubstantial omissions from a record of trial did not render the proceedings non-verbatim. Nelson, simply using the word inaudible, wasn't enough to render the proceedings non-verbatim. Lashley was the unusual combination of factors which just aren't present here. The trial counsel in that case had his questions that he asked that witness specifically, and there was a skeletal audio recording of what the witness testified to, and then Eichenlaub was a mere sentence announcement and concomitant recommendation to the convening authority for leniency that all parties agreed to. Here, there's not that agreement. Looking to the cases where, compare those cases to Boxdale, Gray, and Sturdivant, for example, Sturdivant and Gray both involved sidebars, and Boxdale involved a negligent erasure of 4 magnetic tape belt recordings. In those cases, this court held that the testimony that was omitted could not be adequately reconstructed, and the cases had to go back.
In all cases where all of the testimony of a single witness occurs, is that a substantial omission, or is it a substantial omission in this case?
That is a substantial omission. There is no case where all of the testimony has been erased or not included in a record trial of a government merits witness.
But do you understand the question? Is that per se substantial, or is it case specific? For example, if a witness's only testimony was that the sun came up that day, but that's not, none of that's in the record.
Looking at the case law,
yeah.
It could possibly be a scenario, this isn't it, where it could be, somebody could recreate an entire witness's testimony. If there was for example, United States versus Lashley, where they catch, I guess, bits and pieces of the testimony and they have an audio recording of, or there's a skeletal outline of the prosecution's verbatim questions that they asked that witness. They could then recreate through pretty much the witness retestifying prior to the convening authority taking action.
How do you define sessions as used in, for example, 1103B2B?
Transcription of all open sessions.
Of all sessions. Trial shall include a verbatim transcript of all sessions. Is a session a witness, or is a session recess to recess?
I would define it as recessed or recessed. Anytime the court is called to order until the court is recessed.
So it's possible to have, in theory, not in your view, but in theory, it's possible to skip a witness in its entirety and still have a verbatim transcript of the session. In theory, I mean.
In theory, if, but they would have to catch it shortly thereafter, not 3.5 years later, and come up with a list of verbatim questions the prosecution still had, like Lashley. And so there are scenarios where if it caught in time, it could happen, it could be recreated. This certainly is not that case.
Do you have to show prejudice?
No, Your Honor. Under 1103F, it's not a matter of prejudice. To quote Henry, the requirement that a record trial be complete and substantially verbatim in order to uphold the validity of a verbatim record substance is one of jurisdictional proportion. Therefore, there is no prejudice analysis. And it's not a matter of, as I was saying earlier, merely transcribing only the testimony that someone is found guilty of. It's a matter of transcribing all of the testimony. And a post hoc determination that Sergeant Smith's testimony may or may not have been relevant or was something that Sergeant First Class Davenport was found not guilty of doesn't then make the record trial verbatim. It's still not.
Does defense counsel have any duty to look, to read the transcript and look carefully? I mean, if for no other reason than for clemency?
Certainly, yes, Your Honor. I don't think it would be in the best interest of defense counsel to have raised this if they...
If they had read the thing.
Yes, I'm not saying whether or not was or was not caught. But.
Now, counsel, you say we can't be sure of what Sergeant Smith really testified about, but didn't the military judge at the debate hearing make a finding that it was relevant to the charge of which the appellant was found not guilty?
The military judge at the Dubay, you can't know beyond a reasonable doubt whether it is or is not something to which Sergeant First Class Davenport was found not guilty. And I direct the court's attention to that first sentence in the Dubay findings. The full substance and extent of Sergeant Smith's testimony is not altogether clear. And that's the problem that remains with getting this to be a verbatim transcript. We don't know. It's not clear the full substance and extent of what Sergeant Smith testified to is not altogether clear. And that's why this remains a non-verbatim record of trial. And further, as I was saying earlier, just because he's acquitted of it doesn't make it verbatim.
But it may make it insubstantial.
It may, yes. If we're looking at the case law, it's not this case. It could possibly have made it insubstantial, but not in this case. Especially looking at the cases that this court found the omissions were insubstantial. This case is so far afield from those that this case, the omission was a substantial omission because, as we were saying, it's missing an entire witness testimony and possibly more. At best, what we're left with is a summarized report of Sergeant Smith's testimony. And we're still missing whatever else took place during the proceedings. As such, this case should be returned to the community authority to take action pursuant to 1103F1. Pending your questions.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Baker, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Carrie Ward, and along with Major Ken Bornino, we represent the government in this matter. Appellant is not entitled to relief in this case because the missing portion of the transcript is not a substantial omission. And even if it is substantial, appellant has not suffered any prejudice because the missing portion of the transcript relates solely to charges for which appellant was acquitted. It will not preclude complete appellate review.
How do you get to a prejudice analysis for a violation of a verbatim transcript? It seems to me that is applied to incomplete record, of which arguably a verbatim transcript is a subpart, but we have specifically under 1103 given the remedy for a what happens if there is a non-verbatim transcript.
Yes, sir. Well, I started with Article 59 and then took a look at the facts in this case, where we're looking at a missing piece of the record. So starting with U.S. v. Gaskins, where you did distinguish the two requirements, a complete record versus a substantially verbatim transcript, and then what is the impact on that? We have the opportunity to present the information that this is an insubstantial omission, not necessarily affecting the verbatim nature of the transcript. Take that and then compare that to all the other federal circuits that are out there that are evaluating the same thing. Most have the requirement of a verbatim transcript, a substantially verbatim transcript of a trial proceeding.
Do they have 1103 and what 1103 what to do when there is no verbatim transcript? Do they have a regulation that speaks to the remedy?
Most go back for a hearing, yes, sir.
Well, I didn't hear you.
They don't have 1103, though, do they?
No, not RCM 1103, but the remedy is typically a rehearing, a mandate for rehearing.
So as I understand your argument, you're saying that so long as it's substantially complete, it's therefore verbatim? I mean, is that the argument that you're making? Or is it that it doesn't matter that it's verbatim as long as it's substantially complete?
No, I think it does matter that it's verbatim, but I think we always start with, like, U.S. v. Lashley, U.S. v. Gaskins, you start with the question of is it a substantial or insubstantial omission. And
that's
then once that determination...
That's what you do for whether it's complete or incomplete, right?
I think they're two different questions, but it's the same analysis.
Okay, but what do we do about 1103, which deals specifically with verbatim transcripts?
Ma'am, I think you do start with the same position. You evaluate it for the substantial nature of the verbatim transcript. So you still look at the fact analysis of what is missing from the transcript from the trial and make a determination if it is a substantial or insubstantial omission of the transcript itself. I don't think it has anything to do with the completeness of the record, which is a different requirement under Gaskins. But look at the facts and the overall record of the trial to determine if it is a substantial or insubstantial.
Just to be clear, what you're saying, if I don't mishear you or something, is you can have a verbatim transcript so long with a insubstantial omission.
Yes, sir. I think there will always be error in the trial record. Nelson looks at it when you can't articulate a word and the court reporter writes inaudible. It is not verbatim at that point, but it is substantially verbatim when you look at the overall record. When you look at this record, you have very sufficient evidence to satisfy the findings of guilty of which appellant stood convicted.
Is substantiality measured by length, substance, or a combination of the two?
I think it's a combination of the two, sir. If you look at U.S. v. Lashley, it does say that you should take a look at it both qualitatively and quantitatively to determine the substance of the omission.
Well, of course, the rule speaks in terms of a verbatim transcript. It does not speak in terms of there's enough here to constitute factual sufficiency, which seems to be what you're arguing. You were saying, or legal sufficiency for that matter. You were saying, well, there's plenty here to show that he was guilty of what he was charged of. But that's not the criterion, is it?
No, sir. No, I believe appellant is right that this is sort of a case of first impression. I was not able to find another case other than Lashley that had an omission on the merits. But in this case, as the Dubay judge found, the omission relates exclusively to the charges of which appellant was acquitted.
So, well, does that go to that goes to prejudice, doesn't it?
I also think it goes to substance, sir.
Okay.
The qualitative nature of the omission from the transcript. You don't need that information for complete appellate review. And the language in Nelson and Eichenlaw both address that as long as you have the information in front of you that you need for appellate review, then substantially verbatim, that requirement is met.
Okay. Isn't it the responsibility of the trial counsel to make sure this thing's right before the judge authenticates it?
Yes, sir. I think it's the responsibility of the trial counsel. The defense counsel also does
it. Well, it's traditionally thrown on the trial counsel, hasn't it?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. And the trial counsel didn't do it. Nor did the judge.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, then why shouldn't this fall on the government?
Well, at this point, from the omission standard, there is an omission. I can't get over that. Sergeant Smith's testimony is gone. So then I'm asking you to look at it from the qualitative and quantitative nature of the missing testimony. It is Merritt's testimony, but as the Dubay judge found, it was related exclusively to the charges of which he was acquitted. And that's a finding of fact, which you should be reviewing under the standard of clearly erroneous. And the record supports that. So the trial judge who testified at the Dubay hearing testified that Sergeant Smith, he was very certain, was the language that he used, very certain that Sergeant Smith related only to the charges of which he was acquitted. That's corroborated by the court reporter, who recalled that he didn't really have much else to say, as well as the trial counsel who outlined strategy that Sergeant Smith
didn't. Well, didn't the court reporter think that somebody else testified during this hiatus?
I think she was a little different in the order of March. They remembered who testified, but it was the order in which they testified that where she was different. She said somebody named Mimi testified.
Well, we have Mimi, or did Mimi come back?
I don't think Mimi came back, sir, but the Dubay just found, his specific finding of fact was that no other witnesses were omitted.
Okay, he found that only Smith testified.
That was the only omitted portion, yes.
Okay.
Counsel, what do we do about the statements that this court made in Gray and Sturdivant when they were talking about a non-verbatim transcript and the purposes of that? And they said that what is of concern is not the sufficiency of the record for purposes of review, but with the statutory command regarding the type of record that must be kept of court-martial proceedings.
If I understand your question, sir, I looked at that under the language as addressed in Henry, and then again later in Gaskins, which was cleared up in Gaskins, that this isn't a question of statutory remedy. So there, we have, even if you determine that there's...
Well, certainly if it's a non-verbatim transcript, there is provisions in 1103 as to what should happen.
Yes, sir. And if you determine that...
That's a remedy.
Yes, I think 1103F does absolutely guide the proper remedy in this case, but there is discretion in there to go either with the summarized cap, as appellant has asked for, or in 1103F2, which allows a remand for a rehearing. You know, the omission from the testimony was made on the merits, so we're looking, this isn't a Gaskin situation where it affects the ability for clemency. You know, missing the Good Soldier book is huge. And the what appellant was found guilty was worthy of a general court-martial. So the proper remedy in this case, I would posture, is a rehearing on the merits.
If we were to find that it was a substantial omission.
Yes, if you do determine that a rehearing is...
I didn't think you were conceding the whole thing.
I do hope you don't, but... So substantial versus insubstantial. I would ask that it is qualitative and quantitative. And looking at the entire record as a whole, you're looking at maybe 10 minutes of missing testimony over a 4-day trial. And you're looking at missing testimony that the Dubay judge found was related exclusively.
You said maybe 10 minutes. This is this debate in the briefs about how long was the recess. Could it have been 40 minutes?
I think 30 minutes is an estimate, sir, but yes.
So we don't really know 10 minutes or not. That's a sort of a generalized scale of how long.
Yes, and again, it was based on the findings of the Dubay judge, where he found it to be about 10 minutes and the recess to last no more than 30 minutes. The nature of the information that was missing, again, is found by the Dubay judge, related exclusively to charges of which appellant was acquitted. So qualitatively, it's just not information that you need to do a complete appellate review. However, if you do find that it is a substantial omission, at that point, I ask you to go into the evaluation of prejudice. At this point, I've used U.S. v. Wiser, a Second Circuit case that does a nice breakdown of all federal circuits that do ask this question. When you have an omission from the record, how do you evaluate for prejudice? There will always be some error in a trial record. It is not designed to get to perfection. It is designed to get you sufficient information to satisfy complete appellate review. And all federal circuits that have this prejudice require, or this test for prejudice, put that burden on the appellant to demonstrate some specific prejudice against a material right before a remand or remedy is offered.
Well, have we imposed that kind of requirement? Or the appellant is arguing that basically this is a drop-dead deal. that's not a prejudice thing, that the statute requires this, the rule carries it out, and they don't have to show prejudice. The government's arguing prejudice. Where does that come from other than the Second Circuit?
Well, the one case that was cited by both parties was U.S. v. Bilecki, which was evaluating a case where testimony was missing. And honestly, that case, without citation, looked at it and said, in the worst, it was a sidebar. It was an 802 session that was not recorded. And then how does that affect the substantial substantial nature of the trial record? And that's the worst case scenario. Let's assume that there's a presumption of prejudice that the government needs to rebut. We have done that. For the past 50 years, there's been a rebuttable presumption. You know, the government has the opportunity to demonstrate that there is no prejudice, so no remedy is really required. Gaskins is the final case in mind for that proposition. My argument to you is that that case, U.S. v. Bilecki, which started that line that utilizes the language of a rebuttable presumption, was a little misstated. And it definitely doesn't affect Article 18, under which this case should be determined as a general court-martial. I think the test for prejudice, no matter which way you get there, either the appellant should be demonstrating a specific prejudice that affects a material and substantial right, or the government rebuts it. The facts on this case are going to get you to the same answer. The facts in this case show no prejudice. The trial counsel didn't catch it. The omitted testimony from Sergeant Smith was only cited by the defense counsel in closing when he was arguing for an acquittal on the money laundering charge. Once appellant was found acquitted of that, Sergeant Smith isn't mentioned again. He's not a good soldier witness. He doesn't come up on sentencing. He doesn't come up on clemency. He doesn't come up in 1105 matters, and it doesn't affect action. It's not until we get to the appellate review we realize that there's a missing portion of the transcript that we start evaluating it to determine if there's an issue. So there's no demonstrated prejudice here. There's no actual prejudice here, which means that there's no risk for harm to this appellant. And you need to have some harm to get to a remedy under RCM 1103, either with the summarized cap that you would get under F1 or with the remand for rehearing. You have to have some harm before you offer the remedy. We have to be fixing something, and that's just not the case here. So when you evaluate the three questions, is it substantial? Are you in the overall record? It is not. It's a minimal amount of testimony from a corroborating witness on a charge of which he was acquitted. Is there prejudice? Should the appellant have to show specific harm? According to all other circuits that have a prejudice test like ours, yes, he should. So I'd ask you to consider that as you evaluate it. But even if you don't, even if you do a rebuttable presumption, the government has rebutted that here with the facts that I just laid out for you. And then the proper remedy, this is a general court-martial. He was convicted and adjudged a sentence that was proper. When you look at the companion cases, excuse me, and the charges of which he was ultimately found guilty, it is a general court-martial worthy offense. The omission affects the merits charge, so the proper remedy in this case, if anything should be awarded, should be the rehearing. Although I'd ask you to take a look at that again, in the context of prejudice, you're going to have the same record. So Sergeant Smith is not going to testify again because the appellant was acquitted of the money laundering charge. So he will not be called as a government merits witness. So the record that you have in front of you is complete for appellate review for the charges of which appellant was found guilty. So pending any other questions.
No further questions. Thank you very much. Counsel for the appellant, opportunity for rebuttal, please.
I'd like to reiterate that given the time lag between 9 December 2008 and 2 April 2012 when the Duvet hearing was held, the lack of notes, it is impossible to reconstruct the substance and sense of the questions and answers and arguments that may have been made during the unrecorded portion of the record of the proceedings in this case. Pending your questions.
What do you say to the debate, Judge? Debate judge found doesn't matter. Did the debate judge err as a matter of law because it's just, it's incomplete and therefore you're entitled to relief? Is that your position?
No, not necessarily. Well, that is our position, but also with regard to the Dubay judge's findings, it was erroneous for the Army Corps to adopt the Dubay judge's findings and conclude, therefore, that the record was verbatim based on the what took place at the Dubay hearing. In sending the case back for the Dubay, it could have been possible that once the Dubay was ordered, the prosecution was able to, hey, I found all the questions that I asked in a verbatim style, and here they are.
Just to be clear, do you part company with the government or not on the general proposition that with respect to a verbatim transcript, an appellate court will test to see if there's a substantial omission?
An appellate court will test it.
Okay.
Whether there's a substantial omission.
You certainly split when as to whether there is one or not, but do you agree with the government that as a general matter, one should look to both the qualitative and quantitative aspects of any omission? But your analysis brings you here, and their analysis brings you there.
Exactly, yes. There is a qualitative, based on the case law, a qualitative and quantitative measurement to what...
If we're trying to figure out what law to apply, you would agree. There seems to be agreement on the law,
yes.
At least that far.
Yes. Except with regard to the prejudice analysis under the...
I'd stop you right there.
Yes.
Okay.
There's agreement with regard to the quantitative and qualitative omissions. And looking at the cases, Lashley, Eichenbaum, and Nelson, where this court found that the omissions were insubstantial, this case is very different, vastly different.
You come out a different way when applying that test, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
And then pending questions.
And no further questions. The court thanks both counsel for their arguments, and the case is now submitted and will stand in recess until tomorrow morning. Thank you.
Court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.